Welcome to Academy Watch on the Film Stories Podcast Network. I'm your host, Bo Nicholson. We are currently in the middle of an off-season break because we are not in awards season just yet. But I just wanted to let you know about an episode I did on my other show, Movieversaries, about the 1985 Best Picture winning film, Out of Africa, which won 7 Oscars on that evening. I talked to familiar voice Andy Williams, who is one of my co-hosts on Movieversaries, about Out of Africa for about an hour or so, and we really get into the film's themes and trying to understand how well the film aged 40 years after its release. Spoiler alert, maybe not the best, to be honest. So I think it's a really interesting discussion. We don't go too much into the Oscars of it all, but I still think it's an interesting discussion nonetheless for any Oscars fans out there. So if you don't mind me reposting an episode from earlier this week on another show, here is the Movieversaries episode about Out of Africa at 40 years old in full. Enjoy. Welcome to Movieversaries on the Film Stories Podcast Network. I'm Bo Nicholson. This is where we celebrate and sometimes reevaluate some of the greatest movies ever on a significant anniversary. On this episode, we're discussing Out of Africa, Sidney Pollack's 1985 Best Picture winner on its 40th anniversary. To help me discuss the film, he gives one hell of a goodbye kiss, but he's better at hellos. It's my co-host, Andy Williams. Andy, hello.
Hello, Bo. I don't quite know what to give you at this point rather than anything other than some kind of kiss.
Well, I mean, I would take it. Well, I did say that your hellos were very good, and I think you proved me correct just then, just quietly, my dude. How are you going?
I'm good, thank you, Bo. How's it all going with you?
I'm good. I just had a day full of work and hanging out with my family, and now I'm keen to talk about a 40-year-old film that has a mixed legacy a little bit, Out of Africa, but I'll be very, very keen to get into that. What do you reckon we just dive straight into it?
Let's jump headfirst into our new safari.
Based loosely on the 1937 autobiography of Karen Blixen, written under the pseudonym Isaac Dinesen, Out of Africa stars Meryl Streep as Karen, a Danish woman looking to marry after being unable to lock down a husband. When she agrees to marry her friend Bror, played by Klaus Maria Brandauer, they decide to get away from the frustrations of Denmark and head to Kenya to colonize some land near Nairobi in 1913. Bror has brought Karen to Africa on false pretenses, though. He has no intention of setting up the promised dairy farm and has instead opted for a coffee farm in land where it is risky to grow coffee and with her family money, no less. He also has no intentions of being loyal to his wife. Across the span of more than a decade, the film shows Karen adapting to life as a colonizer in Kenya and falling in love with the handsome Englishman, Dennis Finch Hatton, played by Robert Redford, a super convincing English person. Directed by Sidney Pollack, Out of Africa made $227 million on a $31 million budget. And that's in 1985. Adjusted for inflation, that's over $600 million in today's money that came through the box office. It had a mixed reception from contemporary critics, with the great Roger Ebert offering it 4 stars out of 4 and calling it one of the great recent epic romances, while his counterpart Gene Siskel gave it 2.5 stars, with Robert Redford's performance really holding him back. It currently has an IMDb rating of 7.1 out of 10, a lukewarm Metascore of 69 out of 100, and a Letterboxd average of 3.4 stars out of 5. But there was no doubt that the industry adored this film, lavishing it with 7 Oscars from 11 nominations, including Best Picture. But what I'd really love to know is, what does this film mean to you?
So when I discussed it with my frame-to-frame co-host, Sean Wilson, author of The Sound of Cinema, your favorite book.
Of course.
He, the first thing he did was shout out, you have to talk about John Barry's score. Other than that, Out of Africa meant literally nothing to me. Going into it, I knew not a lot. I'd never seen it. So I came to it pretty cold. What about you?
Similar. I guess my situation is that it won Best Picture and it won 7 Oscars, and you see it pop up in a lot of lists, you know, like 7 Oscars, that's Oppenheimer numbers, you know, like that's Everything Everywhere All at Once numbers. That's a lot of Oscars.
In a big year for movies as well.
1985, yeah, indeed. I mean, I have had some interest from certain people about, you know, like Back to the Future. The Color Purple had a bunch of nominations. Like there's a lot of great movies from that year. You know me, I love a list, and I read a lot of Best Picture films ranked lists, and this one ends up down the bottom of a lot. Like not the very bottom, but towards the bottom of a lot. Like we're down in like Crash from Paul Haggis kind of territory with this one. And so I was really curious about that. So when I put the spreadsheet to you and our co-host Ian, who unfortunately can't be with us for this one, but we can
suck it, Bo.
Yes, we can suck it, Bo, that he can't be with us today.
That's your hello.
Yeah, my favorite kind. He didn't elect to cover this one, but you did, and I did. Mm-hmm. I did out of basically morbid curiosity. How well does a film like this age? And I'm curious to hear why you also wanted to cover it at that point.
Because it was a notorious Best Picture winner that I hadn't seen. So there was a gap. And as we've discussed before, we both like to use the podcast to fill in some of the gaps that we've got. So I thought, hey, I've not seen that. Let's give it a go.
Did you like it?
No. Did you?
Kind of. Like, is that weird to say? Kind of liked
it. No, it's your personal response. It's
kind correct. Of came around to it in certain scenes. I like certain things about it, for sure.
Yes.
There's technical elements that are pretty excellent. You mentioned John Barry's Oscar-winning score, one of his 5 Oscars.
Which I didn't love, which was a bone of contention with frame-to-frame co-host Sean Wilson.
Ah, interesting. So you've already had it out?
Well, to an extent. Basically, I felt that it was one theme repeated. Yeah. It was basically a love theme repeated again and again and again and again in different contexts with different instruments. Mm. And one great theme does not a great score make.
Agree. I found it like it was lush. Like I think the theme itself was nice, for sure. Like it's good music. He's a good musician.
Yes, of course.
But yeah, no, I'm kind of with you. Like it felt like overly sentimental at times, and I feel like that was like the film writ large. It just felt like overly sentimental. To peel the curtain back, I had a really tough time watching it. Like it was easy to find and everything. I bought it for like $5. Which is, you know, a couple of pounds for you. Mm-hmm. And I tried. I put my headphones on. I was really zoned in. I was trying. And I got about an hour in. And I'm like, what are we doing here? To use a soundbite from a previous episode. And, what are we doing here? What's going on with this movie?
It was difficult. It was there's a lot of stuff that happens, but none of it actually really means anything. And there's a whole lot of like white savior complex. There's some really strange acting choices, and Meryl Streep is consistently great, but she's kind of the only great thing in it. The film has a hue, and you mentioned sort of sentimentality. The word I used was saccharine. It just is very, very sort of too heavy on the sugar. Too sweet.
Yeah, a little bit. Probably fair to say that we are, obviously, Movieversaries is a spoiler show. Like, we're talking about very old movies here. If you haven't seen Out of Africa, go and watch it with a tepid recommendation from us, I guess. It's a curiosity. I definitely did bump into a lot of that white savior stuff. And it's interesting because I feel like they thought that they were being progressive. We spoke last episode about Top Hat, how it was sneaky progressive. This one was like loudly progressive, but wasn't actually.
Yes.
It probably felt progressive in 1985, but possibly. So did Rain Man in 1988.
We've covered that as well.
On Frame to Frame.
On Frame to Frame, in one of my favorite episodes, just throwing that one out.
There. Mine too. I mean, I'm biased though.
It just feels very, there's moments of tone deaf white characters going through, barreling in and saying, well, we're going to do this and then I'm going to do this to help people. And just maybe leave them alone. How's that for an idea?
I do like that the film calls it out as sometimes though. There are times, and Robert Redford's character was interesting to me. Because Robert Redford...
He was something.
Yeah. I mean, famously not a particularly great actor. He's somebody that is a great celebrity, a great personality.
A wonderful movie star.
Yes. Yes, that's the thing. Like, I mean, gorgeous looking man. In this movie, he was about 48 years old when it was released. And, you know, just doesn't look like he's, you know, no plastic surgery or whatever. I mean, that's true. There's been some sort of work done. But, like, the guy looks about 48. Just looks really good, you know.
He looks better there than I do now. So,
the Big E tells me you're about 79 this year, though. So,
I am. This is true. as this is released, I have just turned 79.
The Big E, shout out to the Big E. I'm sure he's probably listening. He's a big fan of the show.
What?
Indeed. Now he's a great movie star, but he's not a great actor. But his character is interesting because at times he'll be like, "Did you just like shoo?" This person, you know, that's really shit. And then at times she'll be like, should I offer your person, which is a horrible turn of phrase to describe another person. Should I offer him some food? And he's like, please don't do anything for him. Look, make up your mind, bro. Like, do you like these people or not? but he often calls her out on the white savior stuff. He often calls her out on weird racist stuff and then kind of does it himself anyway. And
I suppose he's consistent in that he doesn't believe that an American should be trying to play a British person.
Did you like that in the intro? Just like, how are we meant to believe this guy's British?
Honestly, his name is Dennis Finch Hatton, for crying out loud. There's no American by the name of Dennis Finch Hatton. That's not how it works. But his full name is Dennis George Finch Hatton. Like, of course this man is from Kensington. There is no way he's from anywhere other than Kensington. So quite why has he got Robert Redford's Santa Monica accent?
Well, the thing I heard about that, well, you know, through the traps, you know how well connected I am. No, it was on IMDb trivia. he had a crack at the English accent, and Sydney Pollack was like, nah, man, this is distracting. Don't do that. And I feel like if he was a good actor, you wouldn't find it so distracting. But it's Robert Redford. Mm. So it's just like, look, just sound like Robert Redford. Like, the main thing is that you're hot and charismatic. Can you do that? And he's like, dude, I'm Robert Redford. And it's like, sweet. Now, I might have embellished that story a little bit.
He's hot and charismatic in his sleep.
Yeah, exactly. Dude snores and you still want to, like, you know, go there. Do it all.
But in an American accent.
Exactly. Yeah, the guy snores. Yeah, like an American. I don't know. What would that even sound like? Y'all. Y'all. You know, like, that's how they snore in America. We'll have to ask Ian Buckley. He'll probably just tell me that.
Suck it, Bo.
But
I can only apologize to Ashley, to Violet, to Ian, any other American listeners we've got for
my behavior. Bo's
strange antipathy and views on the world.
Speaking of strange views, does this film hold up, do you think?
No. No, I think it's... Although there could be a discussion made of them thinking they're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe D.W. Griffith thought he was doing the right thing.
Oh, that's a hard one to take. We might cover that later this year. That's turning 110 this year. Birth of
a Nation. It is. But what I mean by that is intention doesn't necessarily excuse tone deafness. Mm-hmm. And it feels, from a 2025 sensibility, it feels that we're telling a story from the wrong perspective. Mm. We're telling the story here from the rich Danish woman's perspective, as opposed to the people who are literally there minding their business just to have their land colonized by this woman.
Yeah, it's interesting. And it's only 40 years ago. You know, like, I was born 3 years later. You were born a few years after that. Actually, you're 79. You were born ages ago. You remember 1985. What was 1985 like?
It was full of hoverboards and DeLoreans that were able to take off and fly.
And people could, like, go into comic books and sing Take On Me.
They could, and they did.
I agree that it doesn't age well, and I agree that we can sit there and say, hey, nice try, you know? Like, it sounds kind of condescending, but it's like, you guys, you white people, he says as a white person to another white person to a listening group of probably white people, if you're into movies. hey, white people, you tried. You know, you tried this whole, like, race thing or whatever, but honestly, in the year 2025, colonialism, not as cool anymore, not sexy.
No.
Like, we have, the most famous example of it right now, apart from, of course, the British Empire and the American empires, is what the American Empire is doing in the Middle East right now with Israel. And that the colonialism of that situation is just gross. And to watch it unfold is gross. And what this movie does well to sidestep all of that, to make sure we're not seeing barbarities unfold, because in East Africa, the British people were barbaric to the local population. They would massacre them. Like, there were genuine genocides happening over there in, like, 1913 when this was set, and around that time and beforehand as well.
Yeah.
It sidesteps all of that. Like, doesn't show any of it, because it's like, you know, colonialism, we're actually kind of helping them in the long run, right? We're giving them clothes and stuff. So, you know, that's pretty cool. We like clothes.
Yes, but Robert Redford's character is very condescending to his to the natives. Like, he's got a black servant that he will not talk to. He also sort of insinuates that people can't. One of the people in his employ is incapable of thinking about the future, and it's. There's just that casual racism that's still threaded through the entire film, that even though on the whole they try to sidestep the issue of colonialism and race, it's casually racist, which is kind of worse.
Playing devil's advocate, what the film was probably trying to go for was, because let's consider the fact that this was based off Karen Blixen's writings. So she's writing about what she knows, and about 20 years after the fact, in 1937, this was a published book. Mm-hmm. And it's partly based on her book Out of Africa and partly based on other books that she wrote under the pseudonym of Isaac Dinesen. Let's consider what she was trying to say and just see if it holds up at all. Is this an opportunity for the film to talk about how these white people in Europe are so disconnected from their humanity? You know, like, they're going around sleeping and cheating on each other and trying to focus on marriage and blah, 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 and all these things. And then she's, like, so frustrated by the human experience as she knows it that she needs to escape it. And in doing so, in finding a place that is quote-unquote closer to the way humanity started, she was able to regain some of her humanity. She was able to have a true human experience in her love affair with Dennis Finch Hatton. Is that a reading that holds up to any scrutiny, do you think?
I think to a degree, because, you know, she's the one that says, quote, we have taken their land from them. Mm-hmm. She puts herself in that position. I think that whereas you mentioned the term sneaky progressive for Top Hat, I think that's what Blixen was trying to be and trying to represent. But there's still that casual element of the racism and the fact that you've got this film that is almost entirely about colonialism, deliberately sidestepping the issue for the vast majority of it in favor of this love story, which I guess if you swept up in the love story, then sure, but it didn't quite grasp me in that way. Because there's just strange moments, like suddenly Blixen's got syphilis, and then the next scene, oh, she's back in England. Oh, there we go. It's fixed. Wait, what?
And like 5 years has passed or something like that. Like it was like a crazy amount of time. Like by the time that she actually starts having her love affair with Dennis, with Robert Redford's character, it's like 8 years after she met him. But you wouldn't know that from the film because you're right. It just blink and you miss it. Oh, she's got like a life-threatening illness. Oh, she's fine again. And that's...
she turned me into a newt. I got better.
I didn't think we'd get to Monty Python here, but here we are.
Monty Python is always right within reach if you need it to be.
I talked about this on Neil Before Pod with Craig McKenzie and Kat, my co-panelist on that episode, about the new Captain America film. And Craig used the idiom that seems to get around a fair bit, that Marvel is basically like a Happy Meal or a McDonald's fast food meal, you know, like it fills you up at the time, but it's pretty like low quality calories. And by the time, like an hour later, you're hungry again, it's not fulfilling, you know, like especially like recent Marvel movies. It's not a proper meal or whatever. And like, I know that you're more into Marvel than I am, but like, let's be real.
I mean, Black Panther wants a word, but.
Yeah, but that's after Endgame. Like after Endgame, everything changed. Anyway, he was saying that prior to that, he would defend Marvel and say, no, they're not Happy Meals. This is a meal, this substance here. And recent ones have been less substantial. Let's just say that. And I couldn't help but get that impression from this film. This film felt like it was dressed up like a 6-course degustation. You know, this is a prestige meal. And it just, yeah. I couldn't even finish it on multiple attempts. Like it took me about the third attempt to actually watch this thing. And I think it's because so much of what is happening just feels incredibly pointless. Like there's like lions charging at them and I don't care. And she gets syphilis and I don't care. Right. And she's having like marital issues with this guy that she never loved in the first place and trying to convince him that she loves him when she clearly doesn't. I don't care. Like,
yeah, it doesn't do the groundwork. The character work isn't there for us to actually engage with these people.
Yes.
So when we're then asked to care and asked to be invested emotionally in them, we're not. And that's where the score, I think, begins to try and replace it and does so in a very grandiose style, in a very sort of brass horn heavy style, which you can't force it in that way. And whilst you can probably take some of the orchestrations away and listen to them in isolation, and they will probably do something emotionally.
Sure.
But when paired with the characters that you're supposed to care about, they don't do a lot for me.
No, I agree. And when at the center of this film thematically is this idea of, you know, gaining your humanity, like growing as a person through these hard experiences. Like there's no question that her moving from Denmark, like I very rarely pity colonizers, so I'm not going to do that here, but it wouldn't have been like the easiest life for a woman in the 19 teens, you know, to go and run a coffee plantation where it doesn't grow. and get syphilis. You know, like, it wouldn't have been easy, but I just, nothing to her whole experience. And also thematically, this idea of, you know, is love worth it? You know, there's this short-lived love that is non-committal. Like, she's lived a life of having no real love, no one that would really love her. And then finally she meets this Dennis Fitzhatton, and it's like, this is love. There is love there, but it's non-committal. It challenges her traditional understanding of what love should be and getting married and maybe having kids, although she's had syphilis and she can't. And then he dies, and then it's just like, was it all worth it? Was all this heartache worth it? That's a really interesting question.
It is.
That's asked very poorly in a pretty average movie.
Right at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. It takes a long time to get there. And by the time it gets there, I actually do care a little bit about it, a little bit. But I should care a lot more, I think.
But it's also the fact that he dies off screen.
Here, like, is that too.
You just go, and it's like Poochie in The Simpsons. It's just like, and Poochie returned to his home planet and we never saw him again. Oh, okay then.
I'm just looking forward to Out of Africa 9, Rise of the Fitzhatton, where it's like, somehow Fitzhatton lives in the opening scroll. Something like that.
Yeah, suck it, JJ.
Now, I do have a question for you before we get into other things and before we have a quick little break. This is a story that's based in like between 1913 and like the mid-1920s, right? This is a colonizing woman, mostly colonizing men who are colonizing an indigenous population in Kenya. And this is a book that was written in 1937. Now, that's like 1937 is exactly three decades before indigenous people in Australia were considered human by their own cohort. So, we're talking about like very conservative times, even in Denmark, where she's from. Is it possible that we can cut Sydney Pollack and the other people that have made this film a little bit of slack for trying to tell the story as accurately as it did happen? Like, do we want a director that's just like, you know what, 1985, gender and race politics are very different here compared to 1913. So we're going to like retcon all this stuff and make it all a bit different. Do you feel like the accuracy to the time period is actually a credit to the film, or do you think it's more important to have that better message?
If they were so concerned with accuracy, then Robert Redford wouldn't have been American. But I think what I think I would respect Blixen with what she was attempting to do, because I feel that in the movie, she thinks she's helping. She thinks she's doing the best thing that she can. I would then, this is the character in the film, but then the real person who went on to write the book, once again, that book was written in 37. So she also probably at that time thought she was doing the right thing and saying things in the right manner. When there's been a societal change, which happened in the 60s, to then represent these things in the 1980s in the same way that they had been represented in the 30s without examining them, without unpacking them, that is where it feels wrong. And in a similar way, you reference The Color Purple. It's kind of a problem that many people have with that film, is that you've got Steven Spielberg, a white Jewish guy, telling this not white Jewish story, this very not white Jewish story. So when you've got a discussion of race, I think that it's an ongoing thing, and hopefully we're in a better place now than they were in the 80s, and the 80s were a better place than they were in the 30s. But I think that the problem comes from the fact that if you're representing the teens without examining that, because there are other anachronisms in the film that they kind of skip past.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it holds up in that sense?
No, I agree with basically everything you said there. And I guess my next question then would be, is it worth acknowledging that in the whitewashing and the mollycoddling of the storyline around the fact that this is Kenya and there was a genocide and a lot of indigenous Africans died, you know, horrible deaths as a result of colonialism. Putting that just to the side for a moment, I understand that might sound insensitive. Please, listeners, understand that I'm not trying to be insensitive. Do you think that the film is clearly not very concerned with that, in my view.
Mm.
I think the film is more concerned with maybe the gender politics of the film. So, again, we're a couple of dudes, but this is a film that's set in a time period where women, you know, not all over the world had the right to vote, had the right to own property, had the right to run a business, had the right to work even in some cultures. Like, there's a whole bunch of, you know, really regressive stuff from 100 plus years ago that this film is talking about. And by the end of the film, she is finally accepted for a drink into the gentleman's club. How did that make you feel?
I think you've hit the nail on the head in that that's what the film is far more concerned with. Blixen is entering a man's world in many different ways. And she very much throughout the whole film is trying to be the one in control of her life and her lifestyle. Things happen to her, such as her syphilis diagnosis from her cheating husband. But she is clearly trying to be genuine and show a level of empathy with workers in order to help her be accepted into this elitist establishment, because she clearly it's something that she wants, but the narrative and the way in which she's setting up the business exists in order to gain acceptance from white men.
Yeah. And with my 2025 lens, I just find this all very, it's like Baby's First movie about how hard it is for women, or Baby's First film about white people helping black people. You know, it's just, to me, it feels really, really rudimentary and derivative and not particularly interesting, not particularly saying anything interesting at all. Why does Karen want to be in this space so much? Why Africa? Like, at all? Like,
opportunity.
I get, yeah, maybe that, yeah. And not even the great Meryl Streep could bring me along for that ride. You know what I mean? Like, it was, she was trying her best. So she's probably pretty innocent in a lot of this criticism, I think it'd be fair to say.
Yeah, she's, I think, the bright spark of the film. Her performance and the Danish accent that she does is fantastic. Like, she really ceases to be Meryl Streep and becomes Karen Blixen in a way that, you know, Robert Redford doesn't. But, I mean, you can't have a movie about progressive gender roles and gender qualities, and then this movie in particular having Robert Redford as the lead name. Like, his is the first name on the poster.
I suppose he was maybe the biggest star. I mean, she already won an Oscar.
But it's not his film.
Yeah, no, you're right. It's definitely not his film.
So why is he the lead? Like, it's counterintuitive in the way that a lot of the film is.
It's not even a tour, really. Like, it's, you know, like in Top Hat, where you could argue that it's both of their movie, you know, they're both lead actors in this movie. In this movie, you really couldn't make that argument. This is 2 hours and 40 minutes where Meryl Streep barely leaves the screen. Like, this is undoubtedly her movie. Whereas, yeah, he's a supporting character. He's the main support, but he's a supporting character in there. No, you're right. It does. It just, I don't know. It's just a film that bumps me the wrong way in so many ways. And when you asked me at the start whether I liked it or not, and you said you didn't, and I was like, kind of. The more I think about it, the more I don't.
Which is interesting, because it was the exact opposite with Top Hat. The more you thought about it, the first view, and you was like, not sure. But then thinking about it and going into it a bit more.
Yeah.
But this is the exact opposite.
And you've heard me. I'm just like, well, can we forgive this to, like, you know, understand that they were trying to do this or whatever? And it just doesn't hold up to scrutiny. It just doesn't. It's not a great Best Picture winner. The best film of 1985 that I've seen is Back to the Future. I don't think it's particularly close. It's not an Oscar winning kind of movie. I get that, but it's a much better movie. I think people should have known that at the time.
Come and See was also 1985.
Oh, geez. I'd completely forgotten about that. Yeah. That movie is way. That's also Russian, though. They're not going to give. Like, during the Cold War era, during the Reagan administration, you reckon they're going to give. Was that Reagan 1985? It was around then.
I mean, as was.
No way.
Ran. You know, Ran was 1985.
Oh, well, I can't wait to talk about that with Ian Buckley.
There was Rocky IV.
I mean, sure.
Which is one of the great Rockies.
That's Apollo, right?
That is Apollo, yeah.
Yeah.
If he dies, he dies.
Who needs Sean Wilson for our impersonations? That's what we say. Who needs him?
Suck it, Sean.
Suck it. Like, I wish I had a soundbite for that.
You're also forgetting the other great Michael J. Fox of that movie of that year, which was Teen Wolf.
I honestly haven't seen it. So I don't know if you're being sarcastic or not.
We should cover it this year on Movieversaries.
How much time do we have? Like, honestly.
Enough for Teen Wolf.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I mean, like, what, instead of Come and See, Back to the Future and Ran?
Well, I mean, I discussed Ran with Ian on Friend to Friends. You can go and listen to that. So
I didn't. I want in on the fun. That was like a top 20 movie for me, Ran. Well, I haven't seen it since, but when I was like younger,
Teen Wolf,
I was like,
might be, you never know.
Well, that's true. I don't know. We'll give it some thought. Why don't we give it some thought during the ad break? We'll come back and talk about Out of Africa. We're just going to take a short break. You might hear some commercials. You might not. It depends on your algorithm. But we will be back really soon. And we're back. My next question, Andy, is what makes it great? But I think we can pretty much say that it's not great. We've talked about some of the shortcomings. Apart from the whole colonialism of it all, I just found it like deathly slow. It's a long movie. It's 2 hours and 40 minutes, which is not necessarily a criticism in and of itself. And there's a lot of plot packed into this thing, but it still felt slow. I don't know how to describe that. I felt like I was in a trance almost, in a bad way.
I think it's because, like you said, you nothinged it. It was a lot happened, a lot of stuff happened, but that's all it is. It's not necessarily a narrative hanging together as much as it is a few chapters in a life. And whilst you can have a slice of life that would be interesting, like length of a movie is not a huge problem. Unless they use it incorrectly. And this is an example of it being used incorrectly, as far as I can see.
100%. This is a movie that should have a lot of influence, I think. Like, it should. It's got 7 Oscars and everything, but I just feel like it's 40 years later, we're not talking about Out of Africa, apart from you and me, really.
I think it did have influence in what was then seen as a prestige Academy picture, because this is almost exactly what you think of. If you're the type of person, which we aren't, but the type of person to thumb your nose at, oh, it's an Oscars picture.
Yeah.
This is what you're referring to.
Yeah, pretentious, and long, boring, slow, overly just
that became much more prevalent during the 90s with the rise of the art house movement and the Miramax picture and these sorts of films. Like, I don't think you get to that without this being financially and critically successful, or financially award season successful.
I mentioned during the intro, $200-something million in 1985, which translates to over $600 million US. That's an insane amount of money for a movie like this. Like, can you picture a movie like this, clear Oscar bait, You know, Oppenheimer made $900 million, but that was Christopher Nolan attached, you know, like Robert Downey Jr., Marvel legend in there. And, you know, it had like a reason to go and watch this movie. It had the Barbie of it all as well. Mm-hmm. But I can't picture a clearly Oscar bait movie making $600 million US at the moment. I just like, it's just, it boggles the mind. I can't get my head around it.
Actors could open movies back then as well. There's far more choice nowadays. There's far more different screens. The ability to watch whatever movie you wanted at home was beginning to rise in the mid-80s.
All bought this movie on VHS. They're all at home watching Fitch Hatton and Meryl Streep have it out over a campfire.
But, you know, there was – I think that it's kind of like comparing the music charts, right? You're not going to sell the same amount of records now that you sold in the 80s because the choice is far greater. But I think that on an industry level, there was an element of it being influential. I think from an audience perspective, it's been forgotten.
Look, you said you didn't like it, but like, how much didn't you like it? I know you're not a star ratings kind of person, so I'm just going to...
I dislike star ratings.
You hated it? Did you like think it was nothingness?
It was a slog.
Mediocre?
It was a slog. It wasn't great. I'm probably never going to watch it again.
Mm.
But I'm glad that I did, just so that's another box ticked. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, whatever. If somebody told me this was their greatest film of all time, I would look at them and probably just walk away.
I'll probably cut this out because of spoilers. I wouldn't just like look at them and walk away. I'd slide the file across to them and then sprint out the door, Milchek style.
I think that's okay to keep in. Because that's now a meme that's gone.
Yeah, it's probably bigger than the show now. God, that's a funny scene. Holy heck, I can't believe he improvised that. That's so good.
He's brilliant.
Yeah,
he is so good.
He's so good in that show. Speaking of good, what are your favorite things about this movie? As you said, it's a bit of a slog, right? But I'm kind of like you. I think it's mediocre with some great elements. What do you think some of the good elements about this movie?
I think the flying over Africa scene is undeniably great, which is probably the scene of which it's most remembered for. Mm-hmm. That's a moment in the film where the score and the visuals really begin to intersect. You've got Robert Redford's character flying over Africa and seeing some of the great sights from below. And it's wondrous. You know, it's a truly breathtaking landscape with some really, really great music.
I think that probably boils down to where I'm at. Like from about that, around that point onwards is where I start to like the movie. And it's where things like the beautiful visuals, like I think Innocent, director of photography. I think he's done a really, really great job. That's David Watkin, famous for shooting Chariots of Fire and Oscar-winning cinematographer for this film. You know, Meryl Streep's performance, you know, it starts to coalesce a little bit with the script, I think, as well. Like the script.
It gets more focused at that point.
Yeah, like they planted some seeds and there was all over the shop with syphilis and all this sort of stuff and this other pesky husband of hers and whatever. And when we actually get into what the film's trying to do, which is like be a love story and be like, hey, here's how this man changed my life, basically, which I guess maybe sounds like a male savior kind of story, but it's more that like the love that she experienced and what she learned in that relationship changed who she was as a person. Right, so he's the one guy at the start of the movie she says that she couldn't write about because of how much he meant. Right, she could write about all the others, but for Dennis, it was different. right? And when we get to that, that's interesting. And that's why I kind of like the movie.
But that's an hour and a half into the movie.
At least. And see, my favorite scene wasn't actually the flying scene, although I do acknowledge what you're saying. And iconic's not the right word because nothing about this movie is. It's just kind of left the conversation. But if there was going to be an iconic moment, it's
the
that.
Thing that, yeah.
But I really enjoyed the campsite, the campfire discussion.
Yeah.
And I'm curious about this, actually, because as you know, I'm somebody, I have a partner, we're moving in together next month. And, you know, we've both decided that the child-free life is a choice for us. Like, that's a decision that we've made. And marriage is one of those things that I guess we'll talk about at some point, but it's not really high on my priorities list personally. I can't speak for her. She has conflicted views on it. I'm talking to a guy right now who is very recently celebrating the anniversary with his wife. He has two children. How did you read that conversation at the campfire where they're talking about, you know, obviously they can't have children for reasons, but there's this whole like non-committal marriage doesn't change my love for you. It's just a piece of paper. Don't tie me down. That kind of vibe. How did you receive that whole conversation? Because for me, it was the most interesting part of the film.
I see that as an interesting discussion to have because it's one that I did have 10 plus years ago. But the truth of the matter is that I kind of understand that. Like when you're talking about it not being particularly high, children changed our conversation, but it didn't change. The marriage itself doesn't change anything as far as I could see it. But I think that where he's coming from is more of a selfish, philandering place than it would in a different setting, in a different environment. Like for you to say, you'd say something along the lines of, I don't understand why people get married. Like, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but for one to say.
Sounds like you are.
I don't. Okay, for one to say that I don't understand marriage and it doesn't change anything and there's really no point in us doing it. I get that because it's just a legal piece of paper and it doesn't physically change anything. The only thing that's physically changed for me is I wear a ring and that's it. From a legal perspective and from a standpoint, like I get it ideologically, but as far as this character is concerned, as far as Dennis is concerned, given the past and the history that he has, I think what he doesn't want is I was already settled down, right? I was already living with my now wife. We already had a child. We already owned or we were on the property ladder. So it didn't change anything for me, but it would change what Dennis had because he would feel that he needed to buy into that institution.
That's interesting because there is you're right. There is a progressive reading of his views, but then there's also like but dude, you're getting like free rent out of this with no commitment to a woman in Africa in the 1920s, where it's very difficult for her to not be married and own property and own a plantation and all this sort of stuff, right? Like it does read as very selfish. So her decision then to kick him out changes everything for him. Then he starts being really apologetic. Oh, maybe I do love you. Maybe I do love you. I don't know. It's an interesting dynamic. It's an interesting conflict. And then what, he dies? Like unresolved? Yeah. No closure? Like the only closure you have is you're unreliable. Get out of my life. You know? It's... Like, I don't know. I found that part affected me.
I get that. I do get that. But there's a lot of continent before we get to that part of out of Africa.
Yeah, I'm with you. Are there any facts about the film that you were particularly drawn to?
It was more to do with how fascinatingly bad Robert Redford is in the film. You know, the fact that he was told, as you mentioned earlier, the fact he was told by Sidney Pollack to just be you. Yeah, it's fine. It's a baffling choice. I do like that, you know, the way that Meryl Streep developed her accent by listening to Karen Blixen reading her work. Like, I like that she took that time.
And nailed it. Yeah, by I way. Just have you listened to the audio of Karen Blixen?
I have, yeah.
Yeah.
In prep,
freaking nailed it.
It's absolutely something I would never do when watching a film other than for a podcast. So,
yeah. I appreciate that.
Yeah. It was that movie. Was there anything that you in particular liked? Any stories that you liked?
I'm kind of similar to you. I did dig the fact that when Karen was bringing supplies to the front line of the war effort, and
as depicted in the film in a very, very
heroic, yay, the British, and all the Africans loved the British too, you know, God, whatever. And during the night, a lion attacks one of the oxen, right? And Blixen just like grabs a whip and goes at the lion. Now the lion was supposed to be tethered. Like there's an actual lion there. There's a real lion, and Meryl Streep, unfortunately, is like whipping, whipping the lion, which is hopefully not actually hitting, I guess, because animal laws and stuff. But it was the 80s, you know, so. Mm. I don't necessarily trust that lion was not being hurt. Anyway, she was assured that the lion's back legs were tethered so it couldn't hurt anybody, but the lion did not have a restraint and it got a lot closer to Meryl Streep than they anticipated. So when she was like shitting herself in the scene, it's pretty real. Like there was a real lion there and she was there with a whip. Luckily we got a further two Oscars out of Meryl Streep and about a million Oscar nominations because she could have died that day.
This is true. whilst I will praise her for this performance, I did think a little bit of her character Topsy in Mary Poppins Returns because vocally, I think Blixen might have been the starting point for that.
She's like, you know what I do have in my repertoire? I have a 1930s Danish woman in my repertoire. I'm gonna bust that out in Mary Poppins Returns. That's a movie that I completely forgot about. I quite liked it at the time. Mary Poppins Returns. Lin-Manuel Miranda in there doing his chimney sweep thing. That's fun.
It was a big thing in our house.
I bet it was. Big fan of the musicals. Is there anything burning in your pocket about Out of Africa before we get to the MVP?
No, I think we've all but covered.
I've got nothing much else to say about this. I'm just like, whatever. Like, I whatever this movie, you know? Like, it is something. But what we do at Movieversaries, of course, as you know, is we give an MVP. You're spoilt for choice, Andy. Well, I guess one thing we didn't cover is the fact that this thing won like 7 Oscars. Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenwriting for Kurt Lütke, Best Cinematography, David Watkin, Set or Art Direction or Set Decoration, Best Sound, Best Music for John Barry, one of his 5 Oscars. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of choices there. There's also nominations for Meryl Streep, for Klaus Maria Brandhauer, who plays the husband, a nomination for costume design, nomination for film editing. Plenty of choices.
There are, and there is one clear standout to me.
Robert Redford's accent coach.
Close.
Gotta be. It's pronounced Klaus, close, actually.
the lion.
The lion, the one that almost mauled Meryl Streep.
Because the lion was clearly just in its habitat, and the lion suffered greatly in the same way that many of the colonized people depicted in the film did. So I want to shout out the lion.
I've got a feeling that you're lying right now, my friend, about that.
It's Meryl Streep, isn't it? Like, she's the one redeeming feature of the film. And, you know, you could also, I understand the argument for John Barry. Whilst I don't love the marriage of music and visuals in the film, he was undoubtedly a great composer.
Oh, stop pandering. Stop pandering to your friend Sean Wilson.
He's not going to listen this far.
You undersell him. Like, he might be thinking that I'm going to plug his book, The Sound of Cinema, which I'm not holding right now because it's currently at Alex's house in the process of moving everything.
There is a bookmark. Do you not have two copies?
I do, but I gave one of them to Dan Rice. So I didn't feel the need to have two copies anymore, so I decided to give one to him.
Australian animated film director. Australian, yes. Legend that is Dan Rice.
Australian legend Dan Rice. Meryl Streep, okay, a good choice, obviously. She's very consistently good across her entire career. This film also.
Who would you give it to?
Well, a question before I get to that, because it's not Meryl Streep. But where would this sit for you in terms of Meryl Streep performances? Is this like upper echelon or like really, really good but not quite in that category, or like just kind of like run-of-the-mill Meryl? And the rest of the movie is just really,
I mean,
bad.
She's good in a not great film. That's the problem here. So judging the performance as a separate entity to the film, she's good but not great. So probably like mid-tier Meryl.
Mid-tier Meryl.
Around about the same place as Topsy in Mary Poppins Returns, I think.
Really? I'd put Mary Poppins Returns a bit lower. Higher as a film, but lower as a performance. Come on, Dad. That's like a one-scene role, isn't it? Just like...
Yes, it is.
You're lying again.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, she's nowhere near Miranda Priestly levels here.
No. Is that her best role?
For me, yeah.
Yeah, it's got to be in the conversation.
I mean, she's great in Florence Foster Jenkins as well.
Yeah.
But that's another film where she's amazing and the film is okay.
Yeah, it's probably the harshest thing I can say about this movie is that it's boring, and unfortunately she spends so much time on screen being boring that I'm just kind of like, even though I know she's doing a great job, I just can't give it to her. I'm gonna give it to the cinematographer David Watkin. I just think, Like you mentioned before, you know, that beautiful work on some of the big sweeping shots, or like top down on top of a plane or inside a plane. Obviously, there's green screen involved. It was pretty obvious, actually.
It was 40 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you give it a little bit of grace there. And just other things. I think it was just a really nicely shot place. It's the kind of thing that you could understand why people wanted to colonize Kenya if they didn't have a heart for the local population. Because it is beautiful. Like, it's Africa. Like, he makes Africa look insanely, insanely beautiful, in my opinion. So, and I'm sure it is in real life too. And I think he just captures that really well. And I think for me, it was in a film that I found consistently uninteresting, I found the photography quite consistently interesting. So I've got to give it to David Watkin, who won his only Oscar.
Yep, I'm not going to argue against that.
Yeah, so unlike last episode, we have two MVPs. We've got Meryl Streep and we've got David Watkin. Andy, it's probably about time that we call it quits on this one. We ran about 10 minutes over what we said we were going to. Ended up talking a fair bit about Out of Africa. Beforehand, we were talking about the idea that we weren't going to talk that much about it. And here we are, an hour later.
We also peppered in a bit of Monty Python and a little bit of Teen Wolf as well.
This time, at least, no even potential for a pro-fascism take, which was, thank you for editing that with good spirits and good faith at the top end episode.
Well, this could be edited in a pro-colonial way. But
it could be, and I won't be, but I can only assume with you that there is like a pro-fascist version of my diatribe last episode. Whereas just the tip of fascism. Yes. You know, like,
no comment.
No, I just gave you a good idea, didn't I? Damn it, idiot. Suffice to say, we've come to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for your time. You mentioned a bunch, your regular every episode contributor on Frame to Frame, Mr. Sean Wilson. I haven't caught wind of the Citizen Kane episode yet, so that hasn't been released just yet. Is that releasing this week?
Time of recording? As we recall, tomorrow, but it will be out with people as they're listening now.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to catching that one, Citizen Kane and the Night of the Hunter. What else have you got in the bag, then? What's the next episode going to be?
The next episode after that will be something that I know you're going to be very, very jealous of. It's 24 hours in Europe and films that are shot almost in real time.
Oh, no.
Very many single continuous takes. We're doing Victoria, which is a German film set in a nightclub in Berlin.
Uh-huh.
And we're doing Before Sunset.
Sunset. Okay. Have you already done
We've done Sunrise.
Yeah.
We have done Sunrise.
Yeah. I was just like, oh, God, as soon as you said I'm going to be jealous, I'm like, uh-oh. Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. What's my Sunday night?
And we haven't recorded that yet, so.
Can I watch Victoria? Because I saw the Before Sunset not that long ago. We'll have to talk. Anyway, obviously there'll be links to Andy, your other show, Friend of Frame, in the show notes, and there'll be links to my stuff as well. Dude, thank you so much for joining me for this perfectly mediocre film.
Hopefully we made a perfectly mediocre episode.
At least mediocre, I think. But that's for everyone else to decide, I suppose. And thank you to all of them who tuned in as well. We hope you enjoyed the show a little bit more than mediocre levels. If you have, please do subscribe if you haven't already and give us a rating and a review wherever you can. And I have noticed on Spotify, you can leave comments. And I'm one of those people that annoyingly checks that. So please do leave a comment. What do you think of Out of Africa? I'd love to hear it. And do engage with us in the various socials. I'll put links to those as well. While you're here, obviously, yes, check out those show notes because we'll be putting all of our stuff in there, Frame to Frame for Andy, my other shows as well. And do keep an ear out on Movieversaries because we have got episodes with Ian Buckley coming up very shortly and Violet Hammond as well. We're pretty sure we're going to get Violet Hammond very, very, very soon on a recording coming up.
We need the children at this point.
Thanks again for your company. Oh, sorry. These children. Sorry. I was reading stuff. These children. Yes. We're getting. I didn't know what you meant by that. We need the children at this point. I was like, okay, man. What are you talking about?
One of us lives inside of a school and it's not me.
Oh, God. Derailed. Thanks again for your company. See you for the next installment of Movieversaries. Bye.